Support for this podcast comes from Is Business Broken, a podcast from Questrom School of Business. Stick around until the end of this podcast for a preview of the first episode, a conversation with Dean Susan Fournier, where she answers the question at the heart of the show.
From NPR and WBUR Boston, I'm Meghna Chakrabarty, and this is On Point.
I pledge myself to a new deal for the American people. Give me your help not to win votes alone, but to win in this crusade to restore America to its own people.
Well, that was Franklin Delano Roosevelt in 1932. He was then the Democratic presidential nominee, announcing his New Deal for the American people at the party convention in Chicago. And hearing that clip today, that phrase, New Deal, it's easy to think of it as a done deal, a sweeping package of reforms that sailed through Washington and reshaped America in the moment of its greatest need. Well, that isn't entirely true. There is a tendency to burnish the burrs and rough edges off history in our popular memory. So today, in another time of great American need, we're going to take a look at the true, messy process that led to the New Deal and the lessons that process might have for the nation today. And we're going to start off with Jack Beatty. He's On Point News Analyst, and he joins us from Hanover, New Hampshire. Hello there, Jack.
Hello, Meghna.
So this conversation, Jack, was inspired by a conversation you and I and historian David Kennedy had just last week when we were taking a look at the first year after the 1929 stock market crash and what lessons that year might hold for America now as we look forward to the first year post, well, the pandemic still going on, but the first year in the middle of this pandemic and the economic disaster that has ensued. Jack, I wonder if you just could remind us some of the things that you and David Kennedy talked about 1930 as an interesting year to look at.
Sure. Well, I think the essential thing was, of course, the country was in a economic freefall, an unprecedented economic crisis, to which no one knew the dimensions. The future was opaque. People thought maybe it was just another dip in the business cycle, and we just had to wait it out. And in the face of this worsening and deepening economic disaster, economics, the field of economics, was helpless. How helpless? Well, an instructor, an economics instructor at Harvard in this period, was reprimanded by his department head for what? For telling his class, discussing with his class, the benefits of deficit spending. Mm. In other words, it was such a heresy you couldn't even bring it up. And that grip of orthodoxy, balanced budget, tight credit, gold standard, that intellectual, that paradigm, if you will, held in thrall, it seemed to hold in thrall, the ability of a great country to deal with its problems. The first problem was, as Lincoln said, we have to think anew to act anew. They couldn't think anew. And it looked as if the future was going to be, John Maynard Keynes said, a battle between orthodoxy and revolution. But then something else happened, and he talked about what the New Deal was. He said, Roosevelt is the trustee of those in every country who seek to mend the evils of our condition by reasoned experiment within the framework of the existing social system. If he fails, Keynes wrote in 1934, then you're going to have orthodoxy, do nothing. Do not, you can't, no balanced budget and so on. Orthodoxy and revolution will fight it out. Instead, we had a period of what he calls reasoned experiment. Mm.
Well, David Kennedy, Jack, as you recall from last week, he pointed out exactly what you're saying about this fundamental disagreement about the role of government in American life that was playing out in 1930, and I just want to hear back to what David Kennedy said on our show last week.
It was argument about whether government had any role to play at all. So that paralyzed everything. It took a political revolution called the New Deal to really change the schedule of political values in our society so that the responsibility of government to do something became mooted. And we've lived in that era ever since.
So that is Pulitzer Prize-winning historian David Kennedy from our conversation last week. And it naturally leads us to today's show, where we want to learn, okay, what are the actual real lessons that we should glean from the New Deal, from that reasoned experiment, as you quote, Jack. So to help us do that this hour, I'm joined by Lizabeth Cohen. She's a professor of American Studies in the History Department at Harvard University, a prize-winning author of several books, including Making a New Deal, Industrial Workers in Chicago, 1919 to 1939, and Saving America's Cities, Ed Logue and the Struggle to Renew Urban America in the Suburban Age. And she recently wrote an article for The Atlantic headlined The Lessons of the Great Depression. Professor Cohen, welcome to On Point.
Thanks, Meghna. And hi, Jack.
Hello, Professor Cohen.
And for full disclosure, I should also note that Professor Cohen is a member of WBUR's Community Advisory Board as well. So Professor Cohen, start off where Jack and David Kennedy left off in our conversation last week about 1930. In your mind, what was the fundamental argument about the role of government that launched FDR's presidency in 1932?
Well, first I'd start with where Jack kind of left off, in that when he said that in 1930, we didn't know how big a deal this was going to be. By 1933, when Roosevelt came into the presidency, remember, presidents began then in March, mm-hmm. we knew it was bad. That was clear. And we also had an experiment, a failed experiment under President Hoover, where distrust of the federal government taking a major role had proven not to be a solution. So Roosevelt came in knowing he had to do something very different. And so he began with these first 100 days that have become legacy, quite well known, where there were 15 major legislations passed, including a bank holiday that he began with, because there was so much distrust and there were runs on the banks. So he closed the banks and conveyed to people that the federal government would certify which banks were safe, and then they could have confidence that when they returned their savings to banks, the federal government had protected, declared them to be safe.
Well, Professor Cohen, if I may ask, though, those 15 pieces, major pieces of legislation that you point to, even that, though, what did Roosevelt and his administration have all 15 pieces in mind from the beginning, from March of 1933, or was there sort of a rough and tumble process to get that far?
Well, they did have those in mind. Okay. Remember, he'd been elected in November, and this is already March. So the creation of the CCC, the Civilian Conservation Corps, for example, which brought young men out into the country to work in parks and on other kinds of projects, was very soon implemented. And the bank holiday I mentioned, in many of the banking laws. But your point is important, that, they started with that, but they were very experimental, improvisational. If things worked, they stuck with them. If they didn't, they moved on. There was no blueprint. And through it all, the goal was to save capitalism. It was not to create a socialist revolution, as many of Roosevelt's critics accused him of. So that was very important. And I think we can see over the course of Roosevelt's presidency, which, remember, was 12 years, mm-hmm. Very long, as was this depression, that he changed and he grew. And I think that's one of the most inspiring things to me about FDR, is that he evolved.
Well, so can you give us an example then of the experimental nature of the evolution of the New Deal? Is there something that was an early idea that didn't work and they panned it and put it aside?
Well, to start with, one of their first major legislations was the NRA, the National Recovery Act, which basically picked up where Hoover had left off, with hoping that voluntary activity on the part of business, where they were empowered to write what were called codes of fair competition, where they would get forgiveness on antitrust, and in return, they would agree to set prices and wages and hours for workers. And there would be a guarantee that workers could organize, but without a lot of teeth. That was the hope at first, that we wouldn't actually have to have, you know, the hard fist of the federal government. Well, not much happened under the NRA. And when you looked at the labor aspect of it, what it did was give workers kind of a go-ahead to organize, and there were enormous strikes in 1934, but it didn't really set up the infrastructure that made it possible for labor organizations. So by 1935, instead, the Wagner Act took its place, and it had real teeth. Another change that I think I will pick up on a point that Jack made that I think is important is this issue of how do you get this economy back up and running. And, you know, as much as the early New Deal was involved with stimuli to the economy, they still held on to the expectation that you should balance the budget. Even with many of the innovative programs and agencies that were put in place. So when it looked like unemployment by 1936 was down to 14% rather than 25% in 1933, Roosevelt pulled back, and that led to the Roosevelt recession.
Well, Professor Cohen, stand by for just a moment because I want to hear more about that when we come back. And Jack Beatty, hold on too. We're learning about real lessons from the New Deal and how it was an experimental, sometimes messy process, and maybe what that can teach us about how to go through a similar process today. So we'll be right back. This is On Point.
Support for the On Point podcast comes from Indeed. If you need to hire, you need Indeed. Indeed is your matching and hiring platform that lets you find candidates fast. Ditch the busy work and use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. And listeners get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/on point. That's Indeed.com/on point. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed. Support for this podcast comes from Is Business Broken?, a podcast from Questrom School of Business. These days, it's hard to ignore the debate over the role business should play in society.
There's crescendo around profit, period. Is profit bad? Is capitalism evil? These themes are out there.
Is this criticism of business warranted? And if so, how do we fix it? Stick around until the end of this podcast for a preview of the first episode of the Is Business Broken podcast.
This is On Point. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. We're talking this hour about lessons that we can learn from the process that brought about what we call the New Deal. It was experimental and incremental. That's according to Professor Lisbeth Cohen. She's a professor of history at Harvard, of American Studies and History at Harvard University, and author of many books, a prize-winning author of many books, including Making a New Deal and Saving America's Cities. And she wrote about the New Deal in The Atlantic for an article headlined The Lessons of the Great Depression. And Jack Beatty, On Point News analyst, joins us as well. Professor Cohen, before the break, you were talking about the Roosevelt Recession. So tell us a little bit more. What was that and why did it happen?
Great. I'm glad we can go back to that because they were feeling uncomfortable without a balanced budget. They still believed in that orthodoxy that Jack was referring to at the start of the hour. And the result of pulling back in government spending for jobs and other agencies was a real collapse. And so employment shot back up from 14% to 20%. And they recognized that they had to play this differently. And Keynes, who we heard about earlier, at that point had really put out there an alternative, a kind of a Keynesian economics that was very different, that argued that the way to deal with a depression was to spend and into a deficit, to prime the pump. And that was what Roosevelt and his advisors ultimately embraced.
Right.
And still, unemployment never got back to the levels it had been before the Depression. It would take World War II to do that. But things did recover in the late 1930s.
So in this experimental and incremental truth about the New Deal, there's something really, really important there that you point out in your Atlantic piece. I mean, speaking of the Roosevelt recession, you remind us that one of FDR's trusted economic advisors, Alvin Hansen, admitted around that same time in 1937, I really do not know what the basic principle of the New Deal is, meaning that there wasn't sort of an organizing ideology around it.
Absolutely. I mean, again, it's this, let's see what works, what sticks to the wall. And yet there were guiding principles. Mm-hmm. For example, there was a feeling that we had to get people back to work. Many of these early first New Deal, which was Roosevelt's first administration up until about 1935, 36, were oriented around jobs programs. And they cared about consumption. They knew they had to get spending back, but their orientation at the time was really towards work, towards jobs. And then consumption would follow.
Well,
so we can see that.
Yeah. So actually, Professor Cohen, we have a clip from President Roosevelt's first inaugural address where he talks specifically about this. And here it is.
Our greatest primary task is to put people to work. This is no unsolvable problem if we face it wisely and courageously. It can be accomplished in part by direct recruiting by the government itself, treating the task as we would treat the emergency of a war, but at the same time, through this employment, accomplishing greatly needed projects to stimulate and reorganize the use of our great natural resources.
President Franklin Delano Roosevelt in his first inaugural in 1933. Professor Cohen, not to put too fine a point on it, but how revolutionary was it for a president to say that it is the government's job to directly recruit people, it was the government's job to put people to work?
Very radical. You have to realize that the federal government just didn't play a major role in most people's lives. To the extent that they thought about government, it was at a very local level, maybe even their precinct in a city. Or it was, you know, the city government, maybe the county, the state. But rarely did the federal government really figure into people's mentality. And also remember that by, you know, in 1932, the country was filled with first and second generation immigrants, some of whom weren't citizens, many of whom didn't vote. So Washington was very far away. So Roosevelt really had to do a selling job, and he did it very deliberately. So within a week of the bank holiday, he got on the radio and he had his first of many fireside chats where he explained to the American people what he had done, why it mattered, and what the federal government really could do for them. And that was the beginning of a very intimate relationship between the American people and their president, so that by 1936, Roosevelt won in a landslide.
Jack, respond to that about the sort of revolutionary nature of some of the core ideas of the New Deal.
Well, of course, the ideas had been around in the progressive movement and the populist movement, but not the policies. And there was some adumbration of the policies in the period of the World War, when there was a good deal of intervention in the economy and that sort of thing. But all that was thought to be a deviation from the American norm of laissez-faire and voluntarism. I mean, that was Hoover's Achilles heel, really. He had some good ideas about how to get the economy going again, but they rested on this illusion that somehow through voluntary activity, a massive economy could be turned around. It required more. But you know, Professor Cohen emphasizes how even with all the, you know, experiment, the lingering shibboleth of the balanced budget just kept coming up. And John Garrity, in his book on the Depression, points out that Nazi Germany had achieved economic recovery. Depression was gone pretty much by 1936, and not here. Certainly didn't go before the war. And he asks why. And one reason, he says, is the German national deficit quadrupled, debt quadrupled, whereas the American rose only by about 50%. So Germany was really into deficit spending, and the result was it got out of the Depression in 1936. Of course, it was then gearing up for war, too.
Could I just mention a couple of things that I thought of? One in that, you know, wonderful, I love listening to Roosevelt's speeches. He mentions, you know, investing in the nation, in infrastructure, in making use of our natural resources. And that's an important theme that carried through. These weren't just make jobs, you know. I mean, there was a lot of criticism of the New Deal for, oh, they're just, you know, people are just, you know, shoveling dirt and shoveling it back into the hole. In fact, a lot of the infrastructure that we live with today, LaGuardia Airport, the Golden Gate Bridge, the Triborough Bridge, the Oregon Coastal Highway, I mean, a lot of this country's infrastructure was built during the New Deal. So there, that's an important piece. And Jack's mention of Germany, it wasn't the way in which he meant it, but it's an important reminder that all of this was happening in the shadow of a Europe where fascism was rising. So that on the one hand, Roosevelt had, you know, the Soviet Union and socialism on one shoulder. And on the other were Germany, Italy, Japan, also with, you know, embracing authoritarian rule. And so he was trying to sort of carve a path where he really put a lot of attention on democracy as an alternative to these systems, even though the New Deal was accused by many conservatives and many just mainstream Republicans as being very socialist.
So, well, in focusing on the strengths of democracy, that meant that President Roosevelt also had to make some compromises as well, or perhaps many compromises, some of which perhaps weren't to the benefit of all Americans or certain groups of Americans.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, remember that this New Deal coalition was made up of strange bedfellows, if you will, urban masses and populations, but also an important part of the New Deal coalition were Southern Democrats. And so you had the strangeness of African-Americans who had moved to the North, who started off as gung-ho Republicans who recognized what Roosevelt and the New Deal were doing, that they were benefiting from, and began a shift to the Democratic Party. But it was a party they shared with their Southern oppressors. And so that really did put a constraint on what Roosevelt could do. For example, there was a huge amount of popular support for anti-lynching legislation. Not something that Roosevelt felt he could do lest he antagonize these Southern Democrats. when he moved in what is often referred to as the Second New Deal of reform legislation, Social Security, unemployment, fair labor standards, agricultural and domestic workers were exempted from coverage, primarily because Southern Democrats worried that the labor, the cheap labor that they depended on for their economy, would in fact be subject to that legislation. And so Roosevelt went along with that, recognizing that it would take their support to get these things through Congress.
Mm. So that requires a kind of tolerance for a compromise, which I'm not sure we have today, Professor Cohen.
Yeah, it's an interesting point. I mean, I shouldn't convey that there weren't African-American leaders who didn't call out the FDR administration on this. In fact, Eleanor Roosevelt, and who's a really fascinating and very important figure in all of this, she was Roosevelt's legs, because remember, he had polio and was quite limited, but she was also his conscience. And she felt very strongly on civil rights, and she pushed and pushed and did get things that he might not have done on his own with his realpolitik. In fact, later in her life, she regretted she didn't push harder on the U.S. admitting more Holocaust survivors into the country. So, you know, there were certainly African-Americans in the New Deal, and that was very important and a big breakthrough. And they did challenge things. But, you know, we have to look at this in its time. And some of what happened was radical for the time. For example, Harold Ickes, who was Secretary of the Interior, desegregated his own administrative building and dining halls. And that was considered radical, and he was criticized for it.
Yeah. So one of the other things about the New Deal that casual observers of history might look back on is presuming that Roosevelt had a kind of national consensus rather quickly after being elected. But as you point out, that is nothing could be further from the truth, in your own words, Professor Cohen. And I want to play a clip from 1936, October 1936, the days before that year's presidential election. And President Roosevelt, in an address at Madison Square Garden, insisted that he would continue the New Deal agenda and criticized those whom he said put personal gain over economic prosperity.
Never before in all our history have these forces been so united against one candidate as they stand today. They are unanimous in their hate for me, and I welcome their hatred.
Franklin Delano Roosevelt in 1936. Professor Cohen, who is he referring to there?
The business class. And, you know, he took great pleasure. You can see that in building up their animosity towards him and the New Deal. He knew that was also going to rally the troops. He was confident that he had the support of the huge majority of the American people. And he did begin then with that confidence to shift from relief and recovery to reform. And so we see in this period, 35, 36, some of the most enduring legislation that built the American welfare state as it is, of Social Security and so forth. He did really almost use the opposition of the business class to rally people to his side. I think it's important to realize, though, that many business people went along with the New Deal, but they never got over it. Mm. And they continued to fight against it long into the post-war period, and to some extent have not given up yet. There wasn't an argument that historians made in a certain moment that actually big capital benefited from the New Deal and embraced it and used it to push out sort of small business. I don't see that.
Well, Jack Beattie, jump in here, because President Roosevelt was of rather blue blood himself. So how important was it that he reveled in the hatred of that the business class was throwing his way?
Well, one of his conservative advisors, Raymond Moley, listening to that speech we quoted, wrote, "I began to wonder whether the president wasn't beginning to feel that the proof of a measure's merit was the extent to which it offended the business community." And that raises an issue. To what extent did the New Deal sacrifice recovery for reform? Because arguments were made then and since that recovery depended upon business confidence, not some abject submission to business, but just a general feeling that things were going to get better. And that business was not at all confident, partly because of this sort of, denunciation from the president. And it's perhaps Professor Cohen could enlighten us about the tension between reform and recovery.
Well, we will explore that when we come back. So Jack Beattie and Elizabeth Cohen, stand by. We are trying to glean the lessons of the messy truth behind the process that led to the New Deal. And what of those lessons we might apply to today? We'll be right back. This is On Point.
Did you kill Marlene Johnson?
I think you're one of the first people to have actually asked.
From WBUR and ZSP Media, this is Beyond All Repair, a new podcast about an unsolved murder that will leave you questioning everything.
Somebody should be in jail for murdering my sister.
A woman who's never been believed.
As long as they think I have done this, then they're not looking for who actually did this.
And that's what makes it a cold case.
No, it's a botched case.
And a search for the truth, once and for all.
Wow, it just gets more interesting.
Beyond All Repair. Listen and follow wherever you get your podcasts.
Be careful. You're digging in a place that's been very peaceful for a while.
Do it anyway. Dig.
This is On Point. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. Tomorrow on the show, we're going to look ahead to the fall and what school might look like if and when students go back. Will there be social distancing? Will students be going back to school full time? Parents, what do you want to see? Teachers, what would you be comfortable with? We want to hear from all of you. What are your concerns and what scenarios are you planning for when kids ideally go back to school in the fall? So call us at 617-353-0683 with your questions or stories. That's 617-353-0683. We're talking about back to school in the fall on tomorrow's show. Today, we are talking about the lessons we need to glean or learn from the true story of the New Deal. And we're joined today by Jack Beattie. He's On Point news analyst. And by Elizabeth Cohen. She is a professor of American Studies at Harvard University and a prize-winning author of several books, including Making a New Deal and most recently Saving America's Cities. She wrote about the lessons of the Great Depression in a recent issue of The Atlantic. And Professor Cohen, before the break, Jack was asking or wondering to what extent was he willing to sacrifice recovery for reform? And your response to that?
It's a really interesting point that Jack raises, but I don't think that Roosevelt saw it that way. I think he felt that most of the things they were doing for recovery were really not at odds with reform, that they really went together, so that he began to see the polity as made up of, I think, countervailing forces that would balance each other and should balance each other. And there would be three of them: the government, the state, the federal government in particular, labor, which was empowered with the Wagner Act to organize itself in unions that could bargain collectively, and business. And I think many of the programs that they orchestrated were aimed at increasing demand. You know, if they got people working, they'd have money to spend. Even Social Security, a long-term view that if the retired population of this country, the elderly, had resources, they would be spending money. If we had minimum wages, that would increase workers' earnings and they would have more money to spend. And so many of the reforms brought with them, you know, economic benefits. So I don't think they saw it as an either or.
Well, Professor Cohen and Jack, I want to spend a considerable amount of time talking about the broader social and cultural stew that was in America in the 1930s, inside which Roosevelt and his administration were trying to craft the New Deal through this experimentation that we're talking about. Because I think that broader social and cultural environment is really important to this story. And to do that, I just want to play a couple of clips here from other very powerful and influential figures at the time. First is Father Charles Coughlin. He was a extremely popular Roman Catholic radio host in the 1930s. His program, The Golden Hour of the Little Flower, regularly drew an astonishing audience of 30 million people who tuned in to listen to Coughlin's anti-Roosevelt, anti-communist, and anti-Semitic diatribes. Here's a taste.
There is no need of communizing all the factories and the fields and the forests and the mines under a new kind of God made of flesh and blood and clay and hatred.
That's Father Charles Coughlin, the extremely popular radio host in the 1930s. There was also Huey Long of Louisiana. And Professor Cohen, you write of, you describe him as the populist and wildly popular governor and then senator that abandoned Roosevelt as being too cautious. And Long advocated a share our wealth strategy, a movement that he led in the 1930s. And here's an address from Huey Long in 1935.
America will become a land sharing the fruits of the land, not for the favored few, not to satisfy greed, but that all may live in a land in which the Lord has provided an abundance sufficient for the luxury and convenience of the people in general, I think.
Huey Long in 1935, he was assassinated, I believe, in September of that year. So, Professor Cohen, how did Roosevelt navigate that?
Well, you have to, it helps us recognize that this was not easygoing. He certainly had his opponents, but he was a match to them. He, first of all, I had mentioned earlier that he himself made very good use of the radio. And FDR was a showman himself. You can hear it in Coughlin and in Huey Long, but FDR was, was playing the same game. So people were really surrounded by these very strong figures. Roosevelt was, I think, much more frightened of Huey Long than Father Coughlin. Huey Long, he felt, was really a demagogue. He called him the second most dangerous man in America, General MacArthur being the first. And he really worried because he promised people this share our wealth, which would basically be huge taxation on the wealthy and redistribution of resources to everybody else. Huey Long had the common tendency of populist leaders to deliver messages that seemed, ultra-democratic, but to have methods that were very authoritarian. And so his track record in Louisiana was one of where he ran an incredibly tight ship, if not, an authoritarian machine. This really did, it set the terrain. But Roosevelt, I think, then argued for his program in terms that were almost nonpartisan, What we do to deliver security. We are committed, he said in 1941, much later, to the four freedoms. You know, they were, you know, the freedom to speak, freedom to worship, freedom from fear, freedom from want. Who could argue with that? You know, so it did force him at different times, leftward and rightward. But it also, I think, energized him there. And he was a person who was very optimistic, and he conveyed hope and confidence to the American people. And I think that's really important.
Well, Professor Cohen, this is one area of the New Deal which I'm not sure we can apply today. And you know, hearing you say that Roosevelt delivered ideas in nonpartisan terms, and who could argue with that? Today, people can deliver ideas in nonpartisan language, but by virtue of who is delivering them, they are immediately seen as partisan, right? I'm not even sure that politically we can get to that point.
Yeah. I mean, that's part of our problem right now in dealing with this crisis, I think, is that everything is so partisan. But, you know, so much has happened. We have to be careful. There are lessons we can draw. I mean, the experiment from the Great Depression for today, the experimentation, the effort to not be ideological about everything, to try to reach people at, you know, a very basic sort of gut level. But, you know, the world's changed a lot since the 1930s. We have money in politics in a way that they didn't. We have many other kinds of media. It's not just the radio, my goodness, you know. People are hearing from many different sources. But I still think that the right leader could, you know, apply some of the lessons of Roosevelt's success.
Hmm. Well, there's a part of the New Deal that doesn't get enough attention, I think, and you really highlighted it in your piece in The Atlantic. And that is the part where there was essentially a program to launched or programs to increase empathy for the amongst the American people for each other. And that was done by what I still think, looking back, is some of the greatest social documentary in American history, right? We're talking about the photographs of Walker Evans, Dorothea Lange, the writing of several authors. I can remember a couple of them, Saul Bellow. I mean, talk about what the goals were in recruiting artists and writers and why that was so important.
Well, it is impressive, I think, today to look back and see that they considered artists to be important workers. And so initially these programs were invented to get writers and photographers and artists, mural painters back to work. And with that same sort of orientation towards investing in national infrastructure, they were painting murals on post office walls, taking photographs of, you know, different parts of the country, particularly places where people were suffering greatly, like in Appalachia or the Oki, California experience. So initially it was to get people to work, but there very quickly became an awareness that this was doing important cultural work in sharing. Remember, this is an era before television. And so images were newsreels that you might see in a movie theater, or photos in newspapers, but there were many less than there are today. So these images became really important for getting people to see how the Depression was being experienced around the country. And I think that desire to document, but then to try to build empathy was crucial. And you know, today, yes, we are you know, appreciating our package deliverers and our store clerks and so forth. But I'm not sure that that's the atmosphere we're dwelling in. It seems to be more each person on his or her own.
Right.
And not, I think we really should make more of an effort. And I think the New York Times a front page on Sunday for Memorial Day was very much aimed at that, where we saw lists of the people who have died as a result of COVID-19.
So I didn't mean to interrupt you there, Professor Cohen, but we've only got a couple of minutes left, and we just got this message from an On Point listener, Peter Ikes, who's the grandson of Harold Ikes. Did I say that last name correctly, Professor Cohen?
Ikes.
Okay. My apologies. It's one of those names I've always seen on paper, never had to actually say out loud. Who was Interior Secretary during the New Deal. And Peter says that Mariner Eccles, conservative Republican from Utah working in the Treasury Department, was key to understanding the application of principles of deficit spending to restart the economy. And that maybe it was Eccles who sold the idea that without consumers, you don't have an economy. So Peter's saying that the point is that the New Deal, as you're saying, Professor Cohen, was built on experimentation, collaboration, and bipartisanship. And I would throw in there, Professor Cohen, something you've said several times, and that is almost an allergy to ideology. So in the last 3 minutes that we have, 2.5 minutes, I want to just hear from both you and Jack. What do you think, Professor Cohen, are the most applicable lessons from the New Deal in today's America?
Well, I guess I would have to go for an effort to reverse a trend that has been taking place in this country since the 1970s, which is to discredit the authority of government and to argue that the private market can solve most problems. I think we need to rebuild confidence in government, because I think a crisis at the scale of what we're dealing with today, both medical and economic, requires the national government, and then other problems we face, like climate change, require national action, if not international action. So my choice would be that we go for the big one and really try to get people to recognize that the private market does not solve all problems.
Can we experiment? Do we have the kind of government today that can experiment the way that they did in the earliest years of the New Deal?
Well, one thing that would have to happen, if we got a president who was of the mindset to experiment, would have to have a Congress that supported him. Roosevelt had that until the late 1930s, where he met more obstacles when Republicans did better in 38 after that Roosevelt recession. So a president alone can't do everything. Mm-hmm. That president needs a supportive Congress. And Roosevelt got what he wanted. And so it really does take the Congress and the executive branch working together to really reinstill that confidence.
Right. And of course, we have to remind ourselves that ultimately it was the Second World War that fully pulled the United States
Absolutely.
Out of that deep recession of the Great Depression. Jack, we've got about a minute left, and last thought goes to you today.
Well, an FDR goal, I think, that is still and newly and even profoundly relevant is what he said to Francis Perkins, his Secretary of Labor. He said, "We are going to make a country in which no one is left out." Well, that's a noble sentiment, and I think it's something that that everybody feels needs to happen. To speak to what Patricia Cohen was saying, how many people have felt left out, how many Trump voters felt left out of the national feast, the urban feast, how many minorities are left out. That's a big job, and it's a worthy goal for any president. And that and security. Security, as FDR said, against the hazards and vicissitudes of life. Boy, we know about those today.
Well, Jack Beatty, On Point News analyst, speaking with us, as always, from Hanover, New Hampshire. Jack, thank you so very much.
Thank you.
And Elizabeth Cohen, professor of American Studies at Harvard University. Her article in a recent issue of The Atlantic is headlined "The Lessons of the Great Depression." We have a link to that at onpointradio.org. Professor Cohen is also an award-winning author of several books, most recently Saving America's Cities. Professor Cohen, it has been a great pleasure to speak with you and to learn from you. Thank you so very much.
And thank you. I enjoyed it.
I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is On Point.
Support for this podcast comes from Is Business Broken, a podcast from Questrom School of Business. Listen on for a preview of one of the episodes featuring Susan Fournier, Alan Questrom Professor, and Dean.
So let's start this conversation with the title of the show, Is Business Broken? It's a provocative title and a question. Where did this come from? Why that question now?
We're in a big cultural moment where capitalism, business, market systems are really being scrutinized and debated, and the role of business with it. So I think the question is just on the table. It's on people's minds. It's in the news media. It's in conversations. I think there are growing voices, loud voices, especially among young people who seem increasingly to believe that business and maybe capitalism with it are harmful and create rather than solve problems for society. And what we do seem to hear are those loud voices, and they are very black and white. There are protagonists and the antagonists and the pros and the cons, and there's really no middle discussion. It's sort of like people for and against, and it's loud.
Right. For and against DEI, for instance, right? A battle at play.
Right.
The way you describe it and the way you describe the polarization, it makes it feel like very much of the digital age, right? It feels very much of today. Some of those arguments have been around, though, right? Is this criticism of business and this question, is business broken, is that a new question?
You are so right. It is not a new question. Schumpeter, he was a professor at Harvard, and he's also maybe one of the most influential political economists of the early 20th century. He called for the death of capitalism, the death of business, 100 years ago.
Okay. Wow.
And when he critiqued way back then, he said the very successes of capitalism would bring about its downfall because it would create values hostile to capitalism, and that this would particularly take hold among intellectuals who were critiquing. So there's a lot of that same kind of dynamic happening today, and that's 100 years old. But yeah, we've seen this kind of cultural fervor playbook many times in the past, often precipitated by big crises.
Find the full episode by searching for Is Business Broken wherever you listen to podcasts, and learn more about the Mehrotra Institute for Business, Markets, and Society at ibms.bu.edu.